This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll hear from Michigan's newest U.S. Senator, Gary Peters. But first, the Reverend Wendell Anthony is about to begin his 12th term as the president of the Detroit chapter of the NAACP. He will be the keynote speaker Monday morning at Stetson Chapel on the Kalamazoo College campus for the annual convocation to honor the life of Martin Luther King Jr. Reverend Anthony, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
So here in 2015, what are the things that you think that should be top of mind as we stop and remember Martin Luther King in the middle of January?
Well, I think that there are a number of things. Obviously, Dr. King has left a legacy of work, of justice, of fairness, of racial equity, and that is a legacy that is still begging for people to help to maintain it and to fulfill it. We see a retreat from the voting rights that he so eloquently and majestically championed. This happens to be the 50th year since the signing of the Voting Rights Act by Lyndon Johnson, pushed by him. This is 60 years basically, since we have, in fact, moved away from the Brown versus the Board of Education. This is a turning point. The fact that Barack Obama is in the White House, which is a good thing, it still has not negated the hell that many of us are catching in our own house. Even though we are pleased he reflects the actualization of the dream of Dr. King, there are still some things that are unfulfilled. We still have educational challenges, not just in Detroit or in Kalamazoo, but across the nation as to which way we're going to go, public educational-wise. Are we going to go the way of charterization? Or are we going to go by virtue of public education and access for all people? We still have challenges as it relates to the human rights and respect of individuals, judging people not by the color of their skin or the ethnic background of their race or the religiosity that they profess, but whether what they do and how they act and how they relate to you. There's still many challenges. While we have challenges, we have great opportunities. We made some great, great strides to the degree that we have done some very mighty and beautiful things in terms of the kind of representation that we see relative to certain areas of government. The first attorney general, Eric Holder, that we have had, African-American. I just came back from Washington, D.C., in which I participated in the unveiling of the portrait of Congressman John Conyers Jr. He is now the dean of the United States House of Congress Representatives, replacing John Dingell. He is also the first African-American to serve on the House Judiciary Committee several years ago. He is also the first African-American to serve as the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. That goes back to 1813. John Conyers is the first African-American now, and his portrait will grace the walls of the House Judiciary Committee chambers on the Hill. So I think that we have made some strides. In some cases, they've been very substantive. In others, they've been more symbolic. But still, I'm very much enthusiastic. I believe that we still have not seen our best days and that America still has some rivers to cross. And so I simply suggest and encourage everybody to get into the boat, to get a paddle, and help us to move the boat on across to the other side.
Let's focus on education for just a moment. A new emergency manager was named this week for Detroit Public Schools, Darnell Early. I know that there's a lot of controversy about the very idea of an emergency manager, but you have also said in the past that what has the current state of affairs of education in the city of Detroit is also not acceptable. So what's the right path to get to something that there would be some consensus that, yes, there's a quality school district?
I think that's a very important discussion. As you may or may not know, I'm a part of a community-wide task force, the Education for the Future of Detroit School Children, which is made up of business, labor, faith-based, community, foundation, political officials and individuals, all of whom are working to try to structure a new direction for public education here in the city of Detroit, and hopefully will have some impact not just in Detroit, but around the state as well. We are aware that the governor just appointed the new emergency manager, but we also know that the emergency manager situation has not worked. It has not worked to the degree that it has brought about a remarkable change in the city of Detroit, or quite frankly, in any school district that it has been instituted. Even the governor acknowledges part of that, that that's not the answer. It's a short-term Band-Aid for a long-term illness. The illness is the one that cries out for a remedy to assist Detroit's children or children around this state in terms of academic achievement, in terms of parental involvement, in terms of the best way to make certain that they have the highest level of education that they possibly can achieve. What we've asked and we are working towards now, a situation where by the end of March of this year, we would come out with certain strategies that the state and the city might look at in terms of giving our students a new beginning and a new start in terms of their educational direction. We know that everybody is not going to necessarily agree with what comes up with, but that's why, Gordon, we have people around the table who heretofore do not and have not worked together before. You got folk on the committee who are for charter schools, who are for schools of choice. We got folk from the EAA who are on the committee. We got past emergency managers. We have folk who are Republicans, who are Democrats, who are business people, who are community activists, and you know they have issues with one another. But the bottom line is, if we can come out of this kind of group with a strategy or a plan or a draft that would be utilized for the benefit of our children, then we all can have a win-win situation. We have said that let's put our differences aside. Let's beat our swords and our spears into plowshares and pruning hooks so that we can cultivate some system, some plan that works for the benefit of children and not necessarily for those special interests that have held the progress of our students back.
As Detroit comes out of bankruptcy, would education and perhaps jobs be some underlying issues that still need to be addressed beyond just simply the finances of the city? Are education and jobs things that still are going to have to be solved if Detroit's going to have some sort of a bright future?
I think so. As you know, we in the NAACP, we did not support the implementation of an emergency manager for the city. We felt that the city could go into bankruptcy, but we really wanted the city itself, the officials themselves, to be able to do the bankruptcy. And we did not want to lose our rights as people who elected a mayor and the city council to have them disconnected and that they would not have any power. Well, now that has changed. We've gone through that process. The NAACP, we did file a suit a couple of years ago, basically indicating that we were opposed to losing the democracy in our community on the basis of the state filing for bankruptcy. The city did not file. The state of Michigan filed for bankruptcy, which must always be articulated. That was done by the governor and Kevin Orr. And so we were opposed to that. And while we were opposed to that, it was implemented anyway because our case was stayed based on the fact that the judge, Judge Rhodes, indicated that it might result in the stagnation and the secession of the whole process. So it was stayed. It is now allowed to go forward, even though this has transpired. It's now in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. So one does not know what's going to happen there. It could have some impact. It also set a stage for cities in America that are facing the same kind of situation. There are at least 150 other cities in the United States that are facing bankruptcy like the city of Detroit. We just happen to be the first. Chicago is facing this. Cincinnati has some issues. L.A. is looking at some of this kind of situation. Cities throughout California are facing the same kind of situation. Atlanta is not raising no heaven about this situation. So there are a great many cities that are facing financial challenges. Detroit simply happened to be the first one. Now, coming out of this situation, the question becomes, because we look at it, downtown Detroit is going to be fine. There's a lot of development going on. We've said that Detroit is being undersold so people could get it at a cheap price, and that's the case. That's what's been happening. Downtown and Midtown, you got the M1 rail coming through. You got new stadium with the Illiches coming through. You got Dan Gilbert, who's buying up over 60 buildings, coming through. You got a lot of development coming through downtown and Midtown. The real issue is what this is going to mean for the neighborhoods. What does this do to change the situation in the neighborhoods where the people live? We cannot and must not have two Detroits, one for downtown and people coming back, and one for the neighborhoods and people who ain't never left. And so, and unless we can merge those two entities, bringing jobs, businesses, and financial opportunities and access to all of Detroit, then none of Detroit can feel like it's done a good job and it's on solid ground. We're not solid until all of Detroit is solid. I do believe that our best days are still ahead. I do believe that Detroit can emerge and become the best example of what can happen in the community. But that's not because of the bankruptcy. That's because of the people who live here, people who have never left, as well as those who are investing in the city currently.
What you just mentioned there about the concern about the neighborhood, something that Detroit News columnist Nolan Finley has written about, the concern about two cities, one where there's this upwardly mobile, young, white sort of cluster in downtown, and then, as he says, the struggling and frustrated black residents trapped in neighborhoods that are crumbling around them. I mean, you know, he's also mentioning there a racial component. Is that a very real possibility, something that could cause further racial tension in the Detroit area if the uptown is seen as this sort of hip place where a lot of white people go, and yet the neighborhoods where a lot of black people live are not seeing that sort of improvement?
No question about it. And let me say that that's not original with Nolan Finley. We've been saying that for a long time. We're glad that Nolan Finley finally got on the bus with us in terms of recognizing what many of us have been saying since this whole process began. But yes, it is a possibility that it could lead to a greater division. We're hopeful that the mayor, who I believe has some plans on his desk in terms of addressing some of these concerns, and they will be fruitful. We're glad that Nolan and some others recognize that this is not the way to go. Let me say this. I'm glad that people are coming to Detroit, that the communities are being populated. I look for folk to come and to repopulate the areas. Detroit, as you know, used to be a city of 2 million people. It's not that anymore. It's 700,000 or less. So there's room for a whole lot of folk in a city with the kind of 139 square
miles
of the city in terms of what we're dealing with. It's a great opportunity for people to come and to build and to restructure their lives. So we're not upset with that. What we have an issue with is those people who live here, particularly people of color, not having access to capital, not being a part of the deals and the opportunities that are coming forward now. As you may or may not know, there are people who have been downtown and midtown who have black businesses that are now being forced to vacate these businesses because the owners of the business where they've been leasing and renting now want to shoot up the price, now want to get them out, now want to sell the business because they see a renaissance coming to the city. And these people have been here all the time over the good times and the bad times, and now the times are seemingly getting ready to become good. Now they want the few black folk who are downtown out. That's not right, that's not appropriate, and it's going to lead to a situation that none of us want. So I think the question is, can we all come to the table? Can we structure something that's going to benefit the people who come here, but more importantly, that's going to benefit for the people who ain't never left here during the most challenging times of our city?
The Martin Luther King holiday is often a time when people sort of assess the progress of race relations in the United States. As I noted, you have been the president of the Detroit chapter of the NAACP for some time now.
Lord have mercy.
And so I guess I wonder, could you give us maybe just a sense of how you see that progress of the city of Detroit? Do you see things moving in the right direction? And do you think that it has been a long journey to get here with perhaps some stumbles along the way?
I think that it's a mixed bag. I still am optimistic. I am a preacher. I walk by faith, not necessarily by sight, because if I went by everything that I saw, then I would still have a great pause. But I think that there are a lot of good people. There are more good people going than bad people, I believe. There are more hopeful people than people without hope. I just think that we have to step up our hope and our faith and to share it with those who may lack the same. I also believe that as I look at the city of Detroit and its potential, I look at what our church is doing and other churches in this community in terms of housing development, in terms of education, in terms of trying to structure something that's going to benefit the citizens in this community. As I look at the effort that's being made now by this educational task force, as I look at the coalition that we structured trying to address police concerns, as I look at young people who were marching in Ferguson, who were marching in New York, who are bringing something to the table. And one of the things that I saw that came out of that situation was young people that I've never seen before, who are articulate, who command the issues, who understand the nuances and the structures and the responsibility that comes with being engaged. They were not just rabble-rousers. They were not just young people out there trying to create and make some noise, but they were thoughtful. They were pensive in terms of their analysis and their critique. They want to bring about some change. They want to effectuate a different lifestyle. Black kids, white kids, brown kids, yellow kids. So I'm saying that therein lies hope. And because I see that and I feel that, that means that I still have hope. So all is not lost. And I think Detroit can serve as a microcosm, as a model for other communities that have come through the fire, that have come through the maze, that have come up through the ashes, and that can rise again. And I simply believe that, and I live that, and I'm doing my best to try to work for that. That's what the NAACP is about. That's what the Detroit branch is about. And that's what Wendell Anthony continued to strive to be about. I just celebrated my 65th birthday on Saturday. I feel good. I'm enthusiastic. God has allowed me to still have my good, to be in my right mind and have my health and my strength. So until they have to carry me away, and you be talking about how he used to be, how he was on your show years from now, I want to do my best to try to make a difference, and I hope and I believe that there are others who feel the same way.
Reverend Anthony, thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate you.
Reverend Wendell Anthony is the president of the Detroit chapter of the NAACP. He will be the keynote speaker Monday morning at Stetson Chapel on the Kalamazoo College campus for the annual convocation to honor the life of Martin Luther King Jr. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. When the new United States Senate was sworn in, there was only one freshman Democrat. Gary Peters won Michigan's U.S. Senate seat in November after serving three terms in the U.S. House. Carl Levin chose not to run for re-election to the Senate after 36 years. Gary Peters, thank you for being with us.
Gordon's always a pleasure. Thank you.
What do you think you can get done in the United States Senate being in the minority party? Republicans have an 8-seat advantage. What are some of the things that Democrats will focus on?
Well, I think at least in my case, I mean, my focus has always been about people, bringing people together, working on a bipartisan way. So I'm looking forward to doing that. You know, the thing about the Senate is you do need for cloture, you need 60 votes. So Democratic votes are going to be important to move the process forward. And I think what we've got to do is, and certainly the people in Michigan, as well as around the country, are looking for folks to be practical, common sense problem solvers in Congress and get things done and address issues. But let's do it in a bipartisan bipartisan way. Obviously, it also has to get through the president as well. So we've got to work together. That's going to be my focus. That's what I did in the House. Things that I did, for example, was with the auto caucus, where we had over 60 members, half Republicans, half Democrats, and focused on things important to the auto industry and making sure that we were creating good-paying middle-class jobs. So that agenda will continue to be with me in the Senate, and I look forward to it.
Do you see some particular issues where you think there is common ground and maybe you can reach some agreements and get some things done relatively soon that might set a tone for this particular session of Congress?
Yeah, I think there. In fact, I'm going to be introducing some legislation shortly with Cory Gardner, who's a Republican from Colorado. He's a freshman. He was a friend that I worked with on legislation to bring more efficiency and streamline the delivery of government services. We worked together and co-sponsored legislation in the House, and we're going to reintroduce a very similar legislation here in the Senate in a bipartisan way, and I think we're going to find a very receptive audience. So, you know, I'm looking forward to that.
The Senate is set to begin debate on the Keystone Pipeline bill. Congressman Fred Upton, who represents this part of Michigan, put out a statement yesterday saying that it's time to build the Keystone XL pipeline. I know that you and some other Democrats are planning to introduce amendments to the Senate bill. Is there a scenario under which there would be amendments that would get you to support the bill at final passage?
Yeah, I think we have to take a look at those amendments. So there's going to be this is going to be an open rule, which is going to be very refreshing for me. In the House, you're not able to do that. It's very constrained as to the type of amendments that can be put forward. Going through a Rules Committee, my understanding is that this will be a complete open process where we're going to be able to introduce amendments. So I suspect the legislation will conceivably look very different after that process, and so I'm going to wait to see as that goes forward. But as you mentioned, there are a couple of amendments that I hope to introduce, I hope to get passed. One deals with petcoke, which was an issue in my old house district. Petcoke is the residual when you refine Canadian tar sands oil. In fact, about a third of every barrel of oil is reduced to petcoke, which is a coal-like substance. They were piling this stuff up along the Detroit River. It was blowing into people's homes. It was getting into their lungs. It was quite a large issue, and it was quite apparent that we don't have much in the way of health studies related to this stuff. We don't have best practices as to how to handle and store it. If the Keystone is built, this is going to bring an awful lot of Canadian tar sands oil into the United States, and that means mounds and mounds of petcoke. I think we need to have a process to make sure we're handling that properly. So I'm going to be introducing an amendment dealing with that. The other amendment that I hope to introduce, and we're in the process now of drafting it and figuring out the best way to do that, revolves around inspection of pipelines, particularly old pipelines, and particularly old pipelines in bodies of fresh water. And I bring that up because, as many of your listeners probably know, there is a pipeline that crosses the Straits of Mackinac. It is not buried. It's on the top of the bottom land there of the lake. It's over 60 years old, and this tar sands oil is pumped through it. If there were a break in that pipeline, it would be absolutely catastrophic. I know many of your listeners know what happened with the tar sands oil in Kalamazoo, the most expensive pipeline break in the history of the United States in Michigan. That would probably be dwarfed if we had a pipeline break on the Straits of Mackinac. And the problem with this tar sands oil, it's heavier than water. It becomes even more problematic when it's in a water. And to have that in the fresh water into the Great Lakes is simply unacceptable. My passion is always about protecting the Great Lakes. To me, that's one of our sacred obligations as Michiganders, and I'm going to do everything I can to make sure we're protecting the Great Lakes from a potential pipeline break.
One of your committee assignments is the Homeland Security Committee. As we continue to kind of process what happened in Paris, what's the proper response in the United States to that shooting and the concerns about sleeper cells and possible terrorist acts and those sort of things?
Well, it just confirms that we have to be ever vigilant when it comes to that. And certainly our intelligence services and working with the FBI need to be doing everything they can to try to locate these individuals, monitor these individuals, and prevent those instances from occurring. You know, we have a very robust operation in this country. It's not fail-safe as well. But I certainly will be working to continue to strengthen our ability to protect the homeland. But it's something that it's pretty obvious from not only what happened in Paris, but other instances around the world that we can never let our guard down.
How much do we have to strike a balance between our desire for security and the desire to also ensure our civil liberties?
Well, that's a big question, and the one that has to be constantly addressed. That's why I had concerns about whether or not we go too far. There was, as you are well aware, the recent instance where the government was collecting mega data and telephone numbers from folks all across the country. I think there was, after investigated and questions were asked, it was clear that that was going too far, that we didn't need to be casting that wide of net, but that you still have to find that balance where you're able to protect folks in this country, but not cast so wide a net that everybody gets caught in it. That's if we allow that to happen, then the terrorists, in my mind, begin to win because we start losing the very liberties that are so sacred to us here in America and should be with other folks around the world.
Former Congressman Mike Rogers, who you served with in the House during your time there, wrote an op-ed last week that ran in Politico. Among the things he said is that the level of pettiness and small-minded meanness in political discourse is disheartening at best and works against our national interests at its worst. It's hard to solve big issues with small politics. Do you agree with that? And what can you do about it now that you're in the United States Senate?
Well, I think it's just incumbent upon all of us to work to solve those big, tough issues, and that's about building relationships with members. You know, I have served in the minority when I was in the state Senate. I was in the minority for 8 years. I served 3 terms in the House. My first term was in the majority, but the last 4 years has been in the minority, and yet I've still been able to get things passed, bring people together. And I find that it's about reaching across the aisle and just developing relationships with your colleagues. And oftentimes that means developing a relationship about something that has nothing to do with politics, but sharing information about our families, about our hobbies, developing that kind of personal relationship that then allows you to transcend some of the tough political questions that we have to deal with. I had that opportunity with the orientation here in the Senate. You mentioned I'm the opening. I'm the sole Democrat. There are 13 freshman senators here in Washington, myself as a Democrat, and then 12 Republicans. But during that orientation, I got to know them on a personal basis. My wife got to know their spouses on a personal basis. And I think it's that kind of relationship building that is so important to get things done when it can get rough. We certainly have political differences, but we also have a lot in common. And when you really kind of distill down to the very essence of where we are on various issues, you often find we have more in common than we have differences, and we just got to work that through. So I've always been focused on that from day one, and we'll continue to do that in the United States Senate.
President Obama will give his State of the Union address on Tuesday. Are there any issues in particular you really want to hear him address, or anything in particular that you'd like to hear him touch on when he gives that address?
Well, I want him to continue to focus on the economy. To me, that's the number one issue that I've always been focused on in Michigan. We want to make sure our economy is growing and we're in a position where our good-paying middle-class jobs are being created. I was pleased that the president came in to Michigan. I accompanied him when he came into Michigan last week to talk about the auto industry. I just, before I flew to Washington here, attended the Detroit Auto Show, the North American Auto Show, to see all the exciting things that are happening with our domestic auto companies. And of course, that's extremely important for us in Michigan. We've got to continue to have robust manufacturing, and manufacturing sector doesn't exist without a strong and robust auto industry. So I'm hoping that he will continue to talk about that focus, about manufacturing very broadly, that in order for the United States to continue to be a great country, you have to make things. I don't believe that you can be a great country unless you actually make things, and that means manufacturing and a focus on government policies that are going to assist those who manufacture to allow them to do what they do best. And so I'm hoping that's going to be a big part of his speech.
Senator Peters, thank you for your time.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you so much, Gordon.
United States Senator Gary Peters, he's a Democrat from Michigan and Michigan's newest United States Senator. Links with more information and longer versions of interviews on West Southwest can be found at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.